Well, as you all know, the reason why we have met this evening is to acknowledge the Lord's goodness to this congregation, the church that we are meeting in. Although it was smaller, it was opened 80 years ago on this date. And so these are the occasions when I believe it is important. These are milestones in the life and in the history of the Church of Christ, the people of God. And it is important that we do remember, as the Lord told the children of Israel, after their 40 years in the wilderness, he told them they were to remember for 40 years how he had led them through the wilderness, how he had provided for them, how he had humbled them to teach them that man shall not live by bread alone, and so on. And we ought then to acknowledge the Lord's goodness to this congregation. Although the congregation didn't begin 80 years ago, it's around about 110 years old, I think, since its very early and small beginnings. And these things enable us to appreciate that God has a purpose. When he does things like this, he has a divine purpose that he's working out. And this evening we are here to acknowledge that. I imagine every one of you have got one of these little brochures. We're very much indebted to Mrs. Donnell White for producing these for us. There's a lot of work has been put into it, as you will see, and we're very, very grateful to her for the effort that she has made on our behalf. These, in a sense, will become little souvenirs, so they're very valuable in a sentimental way. But I'm going to ask one of our elders, Mr. Kidd, Jeff Kidd, who is one of the members of the congregation who, although he's not an old man, he goes back a little bit further than some, and he is going to come and give us a little summary of the history of the congregation, and I'm going to call on him now to come and do that before we go any further. Mr. Kidd.
I haven't had a chance to talk to Mr. Hutton in the, well, we spoke a couple of days ago trying to organise some things for Donnell, but I haven't had a chance to talk to him about what he would mention, but what Mr. Hutton has just said in his introduction is pretty much where my mind's been about this whole process. There's a couple of things that come to my mind to context for me, if not for anybody else. But back in the day, the Deacon's Court decided to have a Thanksgiving service for 20 years of Mr. Rayner's ministry. And I've got it on the bit of paper here somewhere, just can't remember the date at the moment, but we'll get to it in a minute. And we were really mindful at the time that we, the Deacon's Court, and Mr. Rayner, that we didn't want it to turn into something that was essentially a chest-thumping exercise. We wanted it to be something where it was directed so that we were acknowledging God's goodness and seeking that God would be glorified in connection with what we were doing. It was really at the front of our minds. We were almost scared to do it, but we felt that it was something that was necessary, and we did that. And at the time, I got asked to say a few words then. And then we had Mr. Rayner's retirement in 2012. And despite the fact that I probably shouldn't have, I was asked to say a few words again, and I kind of went off on a tangent in a sense, in that I didn't spend a lot of time talking specifically about what Mr. Rayner had done in the congregation. But what had really impressed me at the time and impresses me again now as I have spent the last several days living over the last 150 years and not so much in 2020, what impresses me is that everything that's happened has happened in God's providence. And we simply have to see all the events of our lives in that way individually. And we have to see the events of the life of institutions like our congregation in that way as well. And hopefully this time I may not be quite as disjointed as I was in 2012, but it's still pretty rough. I'm reading from a spreadsheet, not from a Word document here. So this is dot points that I've tried to lay out in some sort of systematic way that has a rough time sequence. I've written at the top of my page, God's faithfulness. And alongside that, I've just written what Mr. Hutton said, God's goodness to this congregation. The other thought when you start to spend time, I don't know how many of you have spent more than a few minutes thinking about what we're doing tonight, but if you spend a little while in it, there's a lot of things, a lot of places where your mind starts to go. You just can't help it. So one discussion that I had with Richard, for instance, we're talking about 80 years since the building was built, and that's a significant thing. This building is a significant thing. The congregation is the important thing here. You know, the building is amazing. I won't go to the same lengths of eloquency that some people have described it in various church publications. It's a really nice, practical building. It doesn't deserve some of the superlatives that were put in front of words in some of those publications. My mind has gone to what it would have been like then, earlier today, because when it was first built, it was painted cream on the inside, and it's always been blue to my knowledge, so that must have happened a fair while back. Either that or it happened and I didn't take notice. I remember that Donnell's uncle Don painted it. I believe he was probably, apart from what was done with the extension, he was probably the last painter that did anything. Whether it was cream before that, I have to confess that there were a lot of things I wasn't interested in, and I probably never even looked at the walls. I was probably looking at the floor the whole of my church life up until some time after that when he did that. But the building would have been different, and obviously it had different pews. The pews that we don't have anymore, the timber ones, there was some history with some of them. They're just things to sit on. The building is a place where we worship. It's amazing when you listen to the history and see how many meetings were held in people's residences, in the Oddfellows Hall, in places all over the Richmond and Clarence districts. So having a building is a significant thing, but all of these things, you've got to sort of see them for what they are. So when I started to look at it, Mr. Hutton particularly, I think wanted me to look mainly at the period up to when the church was built. So I've kind of concentrated on that, but then I've deviated. So what I found when I started to break it down is that the history of this congregation, not just the building, but the history of the congregation kind of falls into three periods of time that are roughly the same time. So if you want to, you can look at the history of this congregation as the period of time from when it first started meeting together, and you could call, from the start of that period, you could call it 50 years of Free Presbyterian attachment by the Brushgrove congregation, or by the Brushgrove Grafton congregation. That's kind of what I've loosely seen it as. So from somewhere around 1860, people in Brushgrove and people in Grafton started to congregate together, and those people at that time had an attachment to the Free Church in Scotland. So everyone who grows up in this church needs to have some understanding of where the church came from. And so I've got three dot points. So 1560, the Scottish church was established, the Church of Scotland, following the Reformation, with John Knox coming back to Scotland in 1559, and then in 1560, I believe, is the time when the church was attached in law to the state. It was set up in law, so it was called an established church. And that's where, if you like, the Presbyterian church started. And then the next significant thing is the disruption in Scotland in 1843, which is when the Free Church was formed, and it loosely and simply was formed because of the relationship between the church and the estate, the established church and the state was becoming corrupted because of interference in the state with the the state saying who the ministers would be in congregations, and the congregations were having the scriptural right to do things like that removed. That's one of the significant things. I won't go on about it. Following the disruption in 1843, a lot of ministers and congregations lost their manses, lost their churches, and just as an aside, but it's a relevant aside, in God's providence, one of the congregations that lost their manse was located at or near Strontian and in Scotland, and they approached a local lauded landholder, as it were, someone with a lot of property and a suitable place to build a church, and he refused. If you go and read about it, it's interesting, but he was quite antagonistic. The short story was they had nowhere to worship, so thinking laterally, they went down the road, as it were, and organised for a steel ship to be built, which was really a steel church that floated, and they then towed that and located it in the lock adjacent to where they wanted to have their church. And that church was called the Floating Church for the obvious reasons. And the first minister of that floating church was a character by the name of the Reverend Alexander McIntyre. So you need to hold that name in your memory, Alexander McIntyre. And then following the disruption in Scotland, there was a general liberalising trend in the Christian churches, well, not just in Scotland, but throughout the churches generally. But in Scotland, that started to manifest itself in the latter part of the century in particular. Some of those influences generally came from the United States, and some of them came from Germany. And the ones that I think, from my understanding of it, that had the most influence in Scotland, more so than perhaps in other countries, was the influence from Germany, from those people that were styled the higher critics or the German rationalists. And again, these are things that you need to, and Mr. Hutton was particularly wanting the young people to be sort of addressed this evening. So it's, you know, there's a lot of references to these things that you can look up, and I would encourage people to follow them up, because it's not time to deal with the detail here. So in that setting, that social setting of the late 1800s in Scotland, where you've had the disruption in 1843, that you're in a country where there's been religious wars, where you've had the Covenanters, there's strong feelings about these things. A chap by the name of Walter Scott was born in 1854, so just in coming into the second part of the 19th century. And his family was descended from covenanting families, and his father, who was quite a strong-minded man, had joined the Free Church pretty well immediately after the disruption and aligned his family with the new Free Church in 1843. So now we're talking Mr. Scott, as we can call him, was born 11 years later. He became converted, but because of what was happening in the latter part after that, after he'd grown up, he actually left the Free Church and went to the original Secession Church because of the backsliding, as he called it, that he saw in the Free Church. So that's Scotland. And now if we go to Australia at around the same time, Alexander McIntyre left Scotland and travelled to Australia. He was in the middle part of the 1850s, maybe a little earlier. I didn't actually write the date for that down when he came. Sufficient to know that by the early 1860s, he was stationed on the Hunter River somewhere near Newcastle. He may have had a settled charge himself. I don't think he did, because he went all over the place. Alexander McIntyre, we'll come back into the story again in a few minutes, but Alexander McIntyre was highly, highly regarded by all of the Highland Scottish people who he came to see on the Richmond and Clarence, and right down through the Manning and down on the Hunter and everywhere he went. He ended up in Victoria later. But he was highly regarded, and he had a reputation for being a very, very strong preacher of the law. And a lot of people were greatly affected. There's some almost unbelievable stories of reactions to his preaching. But it's obvious that he was very faithful and that he was a strong preacher of the law. In 1861, there had been enough people and there'd been enough interest already happening in the Brushgrove Grafton area that in 1861 they approached him to come and be their minister in Brushgrove. When he would come, he stayed at the residence of my great-grandfather, Thomas Richard Kidd, and his wife, and that's where he traditionally stayed through those years before they left, because they moved from the Clarence River up to the Richmond River in the 1800s. But in this period here, that's where he would go, and both of them were regarded as godly people. So my understanding from family history is that my great-grandfather didn't come to the Brushgrove, to Woodford Island, until very, very early 1860s. So there's a lot happening in a short space of time here to fit all of these stories together. The people must have, very, very early on, so you've got a picture, when these people came, it's only a couple of years earlier that they were actually chopping down virgin scrub to establish these cane farms and clearing land for farming activities. And so it's really early days of Australia. We're talking 1860, and remember that 1788 was when the first fleet came. So we're talking only 80 years from the founding of Australia as a European colony. So lots of things have been happening. There's an excellent book by Ian Murray, if you want to read it, on Christian life in Australia from 1788, which talks generally, and it covers some of the things that cross over with us, and certainly with the PCEA and other early Presbyterian congregations generally. So here you've got 1861. They ask Alexander McIntyre to be their minister. He says, no, I'm too busy, and he ends up going back. But he came a lot. He came frequently with another chap called Alan McIntyre, and I don't believe they were related. But Alan McIntyre had a brother called William McIntyre, and William McIntyre was one of the really significant people with things that started happening with respect to the PCEA in around, just a little bit after this time, around this time, the 1860s. But Alan McIntyre came with Alexander McIntyre quite a lot and visited up this way. And Alan McIntyre, in fact, was the first minister of the Brushgrove congregation. And he was here for a number of years. He left his ministry where he was down on... And look, there's so many different names here. It just... The head spins. And I've got to tell you, there are so many name changes and so many references that are interchangeable between the Free Presbyterian Church of Australia. I don't know what the official names were, but they used names interchangeably, so depending on which state you're in. So there are things that we need to sort out, some of us, to track this and tie it down, because we're too far removed to do it face-to-face now. There's a lot of stuff, but it gets mind-bogglingly complicated. So I've just dealt with it at a simple level. There was a minister called John Finlayson who came after Alexander McIntyre when he went back after a few years. Alan McIntyre was the first minister either 1862 or 1863, depending which article you read. And that's where my mind got sidetracked. There's a lot of things where in one document it says this and in another document it says that. But he returned to the Manning about 3 years later. So if he came in 1862, he went back in 65. Or if he came in 63, he went back in 66, and that's literally what's in the two documents. Back in Scotland, due to health reasons, by this time Mr. Scott was advised to relocate to Australia, and in Providence his passage was provided for him and he emigrated in 1889. So we're up to the 1880s now, and Mr. Scott has left Scotland. Due to a number of influences, and I've talked about the higher critics, so we don't need to do that. So because of the influences of the higher critics in 1892 in the Free Church, the Free Church had been influenced, and a lot of the students and even professors were influenced by the higher critics, and there were a lot of views and things that had actually got to Scotland by this stage into the Free Church, and it was shifting from its moorings. And they passed in 1892 what they called a Declaratory Act, which essentially is a document that allows you to say you hold to all the standards of the Westminster Confession of Faith, but allows you to actually believe what you want about the things you've said you hold to. And that didn't go down real well. But it was passed in 1892, and so it stood. Then what happened was that there was a lot of feedback, which wasn't good, from congregations and presbyteries and individuals between then and the next, was the General Assembly, not the Synod really, the next General Assembly that happened in 1893. There were people were making overtures and there were petitions and all of this sort of thing happened. And then in 1893, after all of these things being sent back, a man by the name of Reverend Donald McFarlane, who had been absent in 1892, he came forward at the end of a lot of debate and tabled a protest on the table, which was a protest against the introduction of the Declaratory Act. And it says, his words in the document says, he did this in his own name and in the name of anyone who would follow him. So on the day, it was just him. And in 1993, some of us were at the centenary meeting of the church in the building where this happened, and in Edinburgh. And it's insane. It's this huge building. And this table, the table that where he tabled the protest, is still there. It's a little bit longer than the length of that wooden device there, and it's he had to walk all the way down by himself, everyone looking at him, and table it. And I was there were 800 people in the building, just absolutely unbelievable when everyone was singing psalms. But if you imagine this building full for a General Assembly of people who all disagree with you, what this man did is really quite remarkable. And so he tabled his protest in 1893, and then you've got, he was followed shortly after that by the Reverend Donald MacDonald, and so the two are spoken of together as starting our church, because once they had two, they then had a quorum, once they got some elders with them, and they were able to do that. And so Donald MacDonald from Shieldag, and a considerable number of divinity students and individuals and then congregations all started to join this body that subsequently became our church. And when I said you need to remember Alexander MacIntyre, Donald MacDonald Shieldag was converted through the preaching of Alexander MacIntyre. And he was he spoke so highly of this man, Alexander MacIntyre. And the effect that is through the blessing of the Holy Spirit that the preaching had on Donald MacDonald was very, very significant. You need to read the stories. So we need to note in passing that the Declaratory Act was repealed in 1905 by the Free Church. It's important that we know that. It's also important to know what the answer is if someone like Mr. Hutton asks you a question like he did the other night at the meeting. Was it the men's meeting? Whichever meeting it was, Mr. Hutton asked the question, so what do you say when someone says to you, why did you stay in the Free Presbyterian Church once they repealed the Declaratory Act? Well, you need to know how to answer that question. If you want, you can ask me afterwards. I'll give you my version of it. But you need to think about it and know why. So you just need to read the history of what happened. So the Grafton and Brushgrove congregations were both approached in 1891 to consider joining the reconstituted Synod of the PCEA. And I haven't got all of the ins and outs of it here. It's important that we understand it. There are important reasons for what was happening, but the short thing is that a union was about to take place, and there are about three or four references in the church history, if you read it, to what is either called an expulsion act or something like the Declaratory Act that essentially can become an expulsion act. And when there's a necessity for it, what some men have done, and it appears to be totally unconstitutional and unbiblical, but what happens is that an act is introduced. There have been, as I said, a number of unions. We're not going to go into which one this is, but what happens is that to have the union, you need to have unanimous votes at things. And what has happened is that men have been put out of their churches because they weren't going to vote for the union. And so they've been expelled. There's been an expulsion of ministers. And so that's what happened with the group that came to be known as the Reconstituted Synod of the Presbyterian Church of Eastern Australia. And that's the body that Mr. Scott aligned himself with and that he faithfully stood for. That body, which was really the start of the PCEA, went from, depending which set of books you read, or either three or four ministers, and grew to about 11 or 12, depending which book you read, by the time we're talking about. And when someone came, and I didn't write his name down, someone came and there was a meeting in the Odd Fellows Hall of all the Grafton people, and they voted, I'm telling you the literal words because I think it's significant, they voted to join the reconstituted synod. They wanted to go with that group. When they went 3 days later to Brushgrove, there was a unanimous vote in Brushgrove. So it says it was unanimous in Brushgrove. It didn't say that in Grafton, so I don't know what the split was. Brushgrove seems to me to have been the place that drove a lot of things in those days. It's just a throwaway comment. It's my opinion from everything I've read, but you don't read about men from Grafton being significant influences, or just there are obviously people here who are good people who joined the church, but it's just in terms of the processes that happened, that's my take of it. So that was the vote, October of 1891. Also in 1891, having arrived in Australia 2 years earlier, Mr. Scott was received as a student for the ministry and he was licensed to preach in 1892. Before, he then accepted a call to Brushgrove, Grafton, but before that, he went and became like a missionary to the backcountry mission, I think it's called. I didn't bother writing that down, but so he was away doing itinerant preaching for a time after he was licensed. Walter Scott was inducted to Brushgrove, Grafton on the 23rd of September, 1894. So remember now that this is September 1894, so it's just a year since the Free Presbyterian Church of Scotland was formed. Reverend Scott sent letters back to Scotland showing his support for what was done by people in the FP Church, the Free Presbyterian Church of Scotland, from very early on once he became a minister and was in touch, obviously, with people. So Walter Scott became the minister and his ministry was greatly blessed and it was obviously well received. Well, for the purpose of this evening, we'll just leave it there. But he, in 1901, with this ministry having been going on and going well and everybody appreciating him as a minister, in 1901 he travelled back to Scotland for a visit, and then again in 1909 he went back to Scotland, and ironically the reason that he left Scotland was to come to what some articles say sunny Australia, in inverted commas, that's not just me doing it, they'd started doing that back then even, sunny Australia, because of his health, and now he's been advised for his health that he needs to go back to Scotland. I'm not sure, you just really shouldn't take too much notice of what doctors say, because give them another 10 years, it's bound to be turned around, and that's the facts of it, So anyway, so Walter Scott goes back to Scotland with his wife in 1909, and while he's there, he addresses the synod and is well received by the church, and to cut a long story short, he ends up staying there and being accepted into the ministry a little while later. And he's then sent off to Canada and is settled, I think, in Chesley. Yeah? And then, sadly, as all of the people in this narrative up until the third page do, he died in Canada and his wife came back with her sister. And his wife was really involved in the congregation. It's obvious from all the different reports. Her name pops up in obituaries from all different people in different places that she must have fitted straight back in. And I know from just the older people that I knew, like Auntie Flora and things like that, and you probably have similar things, but she was a part of this congregation. She was a significant part, which leads you to believe that her husband was a very significant part of this congregation. There were no funny feelings. She comes back with her sister and all the deputies end up staying at her house around the corner in Queen Street at a place called Glenelg for years and years until she's not able to do that anymore. So that's the end of what I call the 50 years of Free Presbyterian attachment. In other words, attachment to free Presbyterian ideals as embodied in the Free Church when it was first formed and as then carried on by the Free Presbyterian Church of Scotland. Next page is smaller, thankfully. So then there's a period that I called 60 years of elders. So from 1911, if you look in Donnell's document, not now because you've got to listen to me, if you look at Donnell's document after the service, you'll see that from in 1911, James Kidd, not that one, my great uncle, sent a letter on behalf of the congregation to the Synod of the Free Presbyterian Church of Scotland. And I haven't got the words here, but Donnell's got them in her thing that were in the letter. And they were essentially asking, if they sent £35, could they send a minister out and could we be associated with your church? That's loosely what it was. And the really, it's from this distance, a lot of things aren't possible to reassemble. And it may be that they were accepted straight away. The Synod certainly received it favourably, but the words that are used in the documentation are vague. They're not what you want to be, you know, hanging your hat on. But the fact was that from 1911, the Presbyterian Church of Eastern Australia are saying, you now belong to the Free Presbyterian Church of Scotland. And as a result, we're going to put new locks on the doors and we're going to send trustees from Sydney. We've elected trustees because you didn't have them. We're sending them from Sydney, you know, don't come Monday. And so that created a lot of bad feeling in the congregation because it was the people in the congregation who had organised the land and raised the money and done those things. And certainly as far as Brushgrove was concerned, they all were unanimous in joining that denomination. But in the intervening period, what happened is slightly vague. Again, it depends what you read and how you read it. But the short thing is that Mr. Scott ended up pretty much isolated. All of the people that were his, you know, like you're sitting at the communion table and you're all side by side, all of the ministers at one end with ministerial fellowship, patting each other on the back as they get out from the table. And then a short while later, Mr. Scott was made to be a pariah because he still held the same things that they all held when they formed the reconstituted Synod of the Presbyterian Church of Eastern Australia. And if you read The Footsteps of the Flock, I thought these people were a bit reactionary and just a trifle on the zealot side. But if you read the extracts from the original documents, it's clear that what happened wasn't done properly or rightly. So I'm talking about prior to the lockdown. I'm talking about what made the rest of the people who'd been alongside of Mr. Scott decide that they could now compromise, in Mr. Scott's mind, and form and go back to a church which had connections with other things that they'd previously pulled away from. So now's not the time to go into it, but I tend to still be of the opinion that what's happened or what the stand that Mr. Scott made, because of what I can see in The Footsteps of the Flock, but also because of other references to other people that historically I've heard what their disposition was like and their demeanour, and these are not firebrands, these are clear, calm-thinking, intellectual, studious, spiritually-minded, godly people. So I'm pretty happy with where we're at. The thing is that these were all men and women of their day. They were all of a generation that's different to ours. Would we do exactly the same things and behave exactly the same way? We may still want to take exactly the same stand, but we may be different in our behaviour because it's a different generation and society at large is different. All of us are different. The stand that they took was an important stand which we need to be faithful to. So, 60 years of elders. So, the elders that we're talking about after that letter are Hugh Grant, James Kidd and Alexander Kidd. They're the three elders that were there by the time the first deputy arrived. I think, and again, I just lost my paperwork, but I think that there was at least one other elder back earlier before Mr. Scott went away that was still alive, but I just couldn't find it again. So the first deputy was Reverend Duncan McKenzie, came out and he met with these elders and he accepted them as elders of the congregation. So I don't know when they were appointed elders in the Presbyterian Church of Eastern Australia, but they were recognised as elders of the congregation by the Free Presbyterian Church of Scotland. So I would assume that because there weren't hundreds of others mentioned earlier, that the majority of these men were elders in the 1890s in Walter Scott's congregation, at least, if not earlier. Why? Ready to be corrected. The significant thing for me that's next is that before he left Australia, the other thing that's significant is, and I've actually got, this is a photocopy of the first two pages inside the first Kirk Session record book for the congregation, and it was obviously started by Duncan McKenzie, the deputy who was there. He's written in it, and what it says is, Brushgrove Grafton, Free Presbyterian Congregation, in connection with the Free Presbyterian Church of Scotland, Kirk Session Minute Book. It doesn't say, like all of our minutes say now, the Brushgrove Grafton Congregation of the Free Presbyterian Church of Scotland met and was... It says in connection with it. So that's why this is 1914. He didn't state categorically that we were a member of the church. He just said in connection with in here. The next deputy that comes, and there's a lot of minutes that this guy does first, the next deputy writes the Brushgrove Grafton Congregation of the Free Presbyterian Church. But so that's why, at least in my mind, I don't know when the synod actually said you are now a congregation of the church. They certainly were connected. They certainly, we just don't have that paperwork. So the other significant thing that he did that explains for me what I could never work out, which was why James Kidd and Alexander Kidd went to Ballina instead of staying here. And the simple fact is they were told to go. And what that deputy said, and I'm quoting from James Kidd's obituary for Alexander Kidd that he was requested to do for another deputy who I can't remember who it was, but he's got a lot of stuff in quotation marks, and the way I would read it is that before he left Australia, Reverend McKenzie, quote, advised, so I'm quoting James Kidd now, Reverend McKenzie advised the Kidd brothers to, quote, so this is what James Kidd is saying, Reverend McKenzie said, to go further afield. And so what they're saying is that when he was here, he went and visited Ballina and he went to all the, there were a lot of people up there, not just the Kidd family, but a lot of other ones that were sympathetic to the church, which becomes obvious in about two lines down further. So that's why they went there, and they went there, and along the way, and I don't know the dates, James Kidd studied with a view to going into the ministry. He went, believe it, if you want to go and study, you want to go to a high-class institution, you've got to do what he did. He went to a college at Casino, and that's where he began his further studies. So after he was at the college in Casino, he then went to a university in Sydney, and it was there that his health broke down. I'm not quite sure what that significant institution was in Casino that he went to. But anyway, he went to Sydney. His health broke down, but he still kept taking services. At some juncture, either then or a little bit later, because of what happened in Ballina, Alexander Kidd was appointed as a lay missionary by the synod in Scotland, and that explains why he was there. He was appointed as a missionary to be in Ballina and to be taking services there. So that means that this first deputy was aware of the people up there, and that's why he told them to do it. From this time, services were taken by Hugh Grant, either at his home at Ian Rollo at Brushgrove or at the Oddfellows Hall in Grafton, and the services appear to have not been able to be held with a rostered regularity. They just happened as long as he was able to, when he was able to do it. It wasn't like it became later on. And if you ever look at the documents and you want to know what Ian Rollo is, and it's just spelt I-A-N capital R-O-L-L-O, and I thought it was some Gaelic name, but they had two sons and one of them was killed in war, and his name was John, but he was called Ian. And the other one, his name was, I think, Roland or something like that, but it was abbreviated to Rollo. So was their two sons that the house was named for. So a lot of the minutes in the session books are conducted in Brushgrove at Ian Rollo, and then there's quite a lot that are conducted at Iona in Lawrence, which is the Kidd family home where Thomas Richard Kidd retired back to in the early part of the 1900s, and where James and Alexander would be when they had to do things with the Kirk session. And the other place is, oh, I've forgotten, it'll come back to me. There's another place where another private residence that gets referenced. So in 1923, those church supporters in Ballina that had, they wrote to the synod and applied to be received, and Ballina was received as a congregation. So it doesn't mean that it's called a sanctioned charge, it just was received as a congregation of the church, and the church acknowledged that. What's said in that writing is significantly more strong than the writing about our congregation. It's just people not being clear with how they word their sentences. So then Donnell's got a list of deputies that are listed in the back of the booklet. So during the time that we're talking about, this 60 years of elders that were taking the services, a number of deputies were sent out, a significant number of deputies over the years. But then we get to the significant point, which is Reverend Donald Beaton as a deputy in 1941, and he's here, and because of circumstances that prevented him, to do with the war, I think, there were more than one deputy held up because of the war. So he, Donald Beaton, was able to stay and open the church. That's the bottom line. Donnell knows the details better than I do, because she's been writing these things. So that's, we had the opening of the church 80 years ago. And the other significant thing that happened then was that 1 week later, so that was on a Wednesday evening. So the 16th of April, 80 years ago, happened on a Wednesday. And on the 23rd of April, Don Shaw, Donnell's grandfather, was ordained as an elder. So pretty well the very next Kirk session, he was elected. He was, for that meeting, he had to act as the session clerk pro tem, which means for the moment, because Alexander Kidd wasn't there. So that would have been like a week after the opening of the church or a little bit later. And that was the first time that he did that job, but he then pretty well did it for all of the years, for a lot of years, not straight away from then, but for a lot of years up until our time. Well, some of our time, not a lot of you because you're too young. So Hugh Grant and Donald Shaw took the services, but Hugh Grant died only a year or so, 1842. He died, so Uncle Don had to take those services mainly by himself through until 1951. In 1951, James Kidd returned to back to Brushgrove, or to Grafton, somewhere. I get so confused now because there's so many different comings and goings. But anyway, he came back here in 1951, and from then on, he shared at least some of the responsibilities for conducting the services until his death in 1959. There's a really interesting anecdote in one of the obituaries, which says that in James Kidd's obituary, which said that he wasn't able to take the services on one occasion, and Donald Shaw was so sick that he literally dragged himself out of the house so that the doors of the church wouldn't be closed when the meeting was supposed to happen. And I don't have all the details, but talk to Donnell because she can tell you the conditions because of his health that her grandfather laboured under at times, especially in the winter, from what she was saying, for a number of reasons, and she'll tell you it's really amazing. And the other thing that the faithful thing that I've written up the top is God is faithful, and that's the overarching thing. But there's a lot of faithful men that come up in these records, and we all need to be faithful to the things that they stood for, the things that they made a stand about. It's really important. 1955, Alexander Kidd passed away and Ed Grant was appointed an elder, and he didn't come from exactly here. He came from Bangalore, and it appears to me, and from talking to Donnell as well, that I don't think, and I don't know if Terry's old enough, but he, I don't know if Margaret can remember either, my impression is that he wasn't taking services as much as what Uncle Don and our grandfather was. And I think that my thoughts are that he maybe did it on Wednesdays and they did it on the Lord's Day. I don't But like, bear in mind, I was in primary school, so it's back in, we're talking the 1960s. And but he was not as involved, and he was an older man as well, so he wasn't as involved in taking the load of that burden. Yeah, so in 1955, Alexander Kidd passed away, and Ed Grant was appointed an elder then. And then in 1959, my grandfather, Thomas Richmond Kidd, was appointed as an elder. And just shortly after that, a few months later in 1959, James Kidd passed away. But he had seen his younger brother made an elder. Then Reverend William McLean comes on the scene in 1958, and he went out in 1958-59 as a deputy to Australia and New Zealand. And then in 1962, he accepted a call to Gisborne and regularly visited Grafton as a deputy and as the interim moderator for the Grafton Kirk session for the next 10 years. He made contact with many others in Australia, especially and in Sydney. And in 1969, Ed Grant passed away. So that's the end of that period. And then we come to what I've called the 50 years of ministerial supply, but I think I've gone far too long. Is that right, Mr. Hutton?
Pardon?
Have I gone far too long?
Well, try and summarise the last bit.
All right. So what happened was that in 1972, Reverend William McLean accepted a call to Grafton, and so Grafton had a minister after 60 years. And Mr. McLean established a number of things in Sydney as well, or he started a number of things in Sydney. I'll quickly flick through. So 1973, the Australian-New Zealand Presbytery was formed with ministers from Auckland, Gisborne and Grafton. And that's a significant event because it changed a lot of things. 1974, Thomas Richmond Kidd passed away, but Richie Kidd was ordained to the eldership in 1974. Another significant person in the congregation died on 14th of August 1976, and that was Flora Shaw, who's the woman who donated the house around in Victoria Street to become a manse. And that home was a really nice place, which William McLean described as she donated her mansion to the church, which maybe it was perhaps a slight exaggeration, but it was certainly a very, very generous thing to do. And then, obviously, the next most significant thing is that on the 24th of November 1976, Reverend Rayner was inducted as the minister of the congregation. And that's the significant part of the 50 years of ministerial supply. The things that Reverend William McLean did were important because as a deputy, he kept the congregation going here in a lot of ways in terms of contact with the church and organising things that we wouldn't have known to do, or the people then wouldn't have known to do otherwise. So that was significant. But obviously having a minister that was settled here for so long, from 1976, is the single biggest significant thing in terms of the congregation. And that's something that is really, really amazing. We'd gone for 60 years with elders taking the service, and we then got to, and that's amazing too, that faithful men were able to, especially considering their age, especially considering the fact that elders have work to do. And, That's a really significant thing. But then to have a minister settled here that stayed here and was able to carry on what William McLean had started as far as things in Sydney were concerned and contacts with other people around the country and also in terms of participation in the presbytery, that's a really significant thing. And that's why as a congregation we wanted to give thanks after 20 years of ministry. And why at Mr. Rayner's retirement, why we wanted to acknowledge the Lord's goodness on that occasion as well. It was just an amazing thing to have had that ministry for so long. Mr. Rayner was involved in the presbytery, but also in going back to synod as well. The presbytery involvement when Reverend William was here was really just him. No elders went into presbytery visits, but Mr. Rayner started. Uncle Richie went first of all, and then I started going for a long time and Uncle Richie couldn't. So getting involved in the presbytery at that level was something which didn't really get underway until Mr. Rayner came, and that's a significant thing. In my mind, the fact that Mr. Rayner and Uncle Joe, Mr. Van Dorp, were the ones that carried the load, the ministerial load in this presbytery for all those years, the thing that used to always be in my mind is, you know, back then there were telephones, but there just wasn't the contact. And ministerial fellowship, just The ministerial fellowship generally, apart from when a deputy would come, was between Mr. Rayner and Mr. Van Dorp, and particularly when they'd get together at presbytery meetings and communion. So that's being isolated from Scotland. That, in my mind, is having been isolated from everything as a person who grew up in Grafton. I know what isolation means. And like to be a minister and to be isolated from all of the things that are happening in the church, it made for a lot of difficulties. On the one hand, there's a lot of fellowship that happened in presbytery meetings and Kirk session meetings. On the other hand, there's a lot of, at times, disagreements, differences of opinion. But I think that's a significant thing to see that changed with the coming of a minister, was that we were involved in a local presbytery, warts and all. We were involved in a local presbytery and had at least some say and some involvement. And Mr. Rayner, as the moderator of that presbytery, and Mr. Van Dorp as the clerk of that presbytery, they were it. That's it. So whatever happened, yeah, they were it, you know. And that is important for us to remember. And I've got a lot of memories about being involved in those presbytery meetings, and there were some really difficult things. But if you ever think you've seen the power of the Holy Spirit working, it's kind of at 1 o'clock on a Tuesday morning when you finally get a resolution of something that, humanly speaking, had no resolution because you just had two sides at total loggerheads. They're kind of special times. There were other elders. Alistair Shaw was made an elder in 1980. My dad, Murray, and I were made deacons in 81. Dad was ordained at the end of 81. That was the beginning for the deaconship. Dad was made an elder at the end of 81. Auntie Florrie, Miss Shaw, I talked about, she'd passed away. Auntie Irene passed away in 1981. And Mr. Rayner, the other thing that changed was, well, there was no one to get married because there were no young people. I mean, old people don't get married. And that's what the congregation was before Mr. Rayner came here. But one of the big things was we had marriages. We had weddings, you know, from 1970, 1980. It was really, really different. It was a different world. A lot of things changed. The Sydney congregation started the services that Mr. McLean had started randomly. Mr. Rayner took over those things, and then they started to happen differently. And then you have the time when Alistair Shaw and Jake Van Praagh were taking services for a while, and then Uncle Al passed away. Sadly, a few years into that, then all the involvement in Sydney, because they didn't have their own Kirk session. So the purchase of their block of land at Llandeilo, the sale of that, the purchase of the building, all of those things were done through Mr. Rayner and assessor elders that went down to Sydney. Some of us may have been the only assessor elder that went down to Sydney. So there's a lot of involvement in Sydney, officially anyway. Everyone from the congregation, when they came along, everyone else, all the other families, tried to go down as well. But in the early days, there was just a lot happening. The Sydney people had three deacons elected initially, and so it goes. Mr. Rayner went to synod lots of times and was the moderator on one occasion, if I recall, 20 years of Thanksgiving in 96. And then the significant thing when Mr. Rayner retired was, and I can't remember, I think he had it in a sermon, but certainly it was being discussed a lot, was those words, "Is anything too hard for the Lord?" As we came to that period as a congregation when we realised that Mr. Rayner was retiring, how on earth, you know, like, how are we ever going to get a minister here? It just was the most, if you do a survey, what is the most unlikely thing to happen in the FB congregation in Grafton in the next 25 years, that you ever get another minister? It's the most unlikely thing. It just, humanly speaking, it just was. But this text had been on, if I recall, Mr. Rayner was the one that mentioned it first, and it was really on my mind at his retirement thing, and it became a real focus for us. Is anything too hard for the Lord? And so when an approach was made to Mr. Hutton, I was a mess. I'd been a mess for a while. And I pretty well was missing in action for the last part of Mr. Rayner's ministry and the beginning of Mr. Hutton's ministry. And so there's obviously a lot of gaps here from my perspective, but that's a really significant memory, that is anything too hard for the Lord? And when you looked at the history of how the Shaw family and the Kidd family came together on Woodford Island, all of the things in Providence that had happened before they got there, with shipwrecks and relatives like the the grandfather or the patriarch of that family dying on the way out, all of these things happening for the Shaw family. It was absolutely amazing. It's not a coincidence that these people met on Woodford Island, and from the time in 1860 when they got together, that they were within a year or two after Alexander McIntyre had become their minister. And he says no, but they get Alan McIntyre, and there's another minister after that, and not too much later after he's gone because of whatever, then Mr. Scott comes along and he's here, and Mr. Scott's influence, I think, is immense. You have to read into it, apart from anything else, whatever you think. His influence and the way that the men of that congregation looked up to him is immense. There's an anecdote that I won't say here, but it just blows my mind, the level of trust and confidence and the way that they saw him as a godly, faithful minister of the gospel. And I believe that's what we've been blessed with up until now. And to have Mr. Hutton's ministry now, since he came at the end of 2014, I just simply can't get my head around the fact that God has provided for us in this way. And we need to acknowledge all of those things as a congregation in this building that was provided. We don't have to meet on the front veranda at Ian Rollo, or we don't have to go down to sit out in the dining room at Iona at Lawrence. We've got a church building that's been provided. The dollars were sorted out very early on. There was a loan, which was interest-free, that was then sorted out. And this congregation has been provided for by the Lord, and it's amazing. All of us have a spiritual heritage that goes back to, obviously, to John Knox, but then after that to the Free Church. It was the principles that they stood for in 1843 that the people in 1893 wanted to adhere to, and then the people a little later in Australia in the 1890s, and then subsequently ever since then. So, sorry I talked too long, but that's my personal comments, obviously. And things that have come to me, having been sort of buried in it for the last, literally up until about 10 minutes before we came out for church tonight. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Jeff.